All right, if you'd turn to your Bibles to Esther, we're at chapter 7 tonight. Next week, we're going to finish up the book of Esther, and we will be going from there into the book of Job. A long book, Job will stretch you, and it'll stretch me. And so I'm looking forward to that study. So, Esther chapter 7, when we left off this story last week, the plot had thickened to the point that you could feel the intensity of the words. Don't you love reading Bible stories when they get to that point where it's just, whoa, this is a good story? In fact, Gary Pierce told me, he says, why don't they make a movie out of this? Esther would be a great book to make a movie out of, and it's true. But you could feel that intensity of everybody there at Haman's house. Good old Haman. He wasn't having the party that he'd expected to have. I like how the author does it. While they were still talking, it says, the king's eunuchs came, and he hastened to bring Haman. He hastened to bring Haman. Oh boy, there was a lot said in that short few words. They were in a hurry to deal with this Haman, and now the scene was going to shift from Haman's plotting and God behind the scenes. Listen to me carefully. As God is more often behind the scenes in our lives, He moves perfectly as He's doing that behind the scenes. Now we're going to see tonight that God moves out into really just a flurry, where there's a flow like a swift river current. And when you get caught up in it, there's no getting out of it. God's current is swift. I have talked to, I don't know how many people that say, well, you know what? I'm going to get right with God when it gets close to time to get right with Him. I'm going to party it up for a while. I'm going to do my thing until it's time to get right with God. When I see the signs on the horizon, I'll pay attention. My friends, that is so wrong. That's a wrong way of thinking, because once God starts moving, the current is swift and it is quick. And before you know it, the rapture will happen in 1/1000th of a second. There will be no time. He is almost, he's at work here in everyone's lives today, as he is in the story of Haman. And we can know that he's at work because he has a preparation to do in our hearts for the next big event. I have a hard time learning to set patiently. My wife, she doesn't say anything there, but she knows that's true. Oh, patience is difficult, but that is the time that you need to learn to prepare for the next great victory over the enemy. But that is what we must do, because we will see here in this story tonight that it does not take God very long to administer judgment on old Haman, the enemy, when it is time. So let's get into the first couple of verses there. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom it shall be done." So Esther has her second banquet. Remember the first one? This one here, it would be a dinner. The next day after the first one, which was lunch, when wine is served, it's customary in those days, and some parts of the world even today, they serve wine right with dinners. And so they got their glass of wine, and they had their dinner, and they kind of kicked back and started to engage in conversation. And once again, this king, he's not used to being put off, and he says to the queen, Esther, he said, what's on your mind now? What's all the reasoning? What's behind this? Don't be shy. I'll give you up to half of my kingdom if you'll tell me, he says. And she had set it up perfectly. She had him eating out of her hand. She had his total, undivided attention. So then Queen Esther answered and said in verse 3, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request." She begins by finding favor in his sight. If I have pleased you, she would say to the king, and if it makes you happy, let me leave and live. Let my people live. This was a bombshell. Because remember, King Ahasuerus, he had no idea he had married a Jew. He didn't have a clue. And she drops this bombshell at dinner, around the wine. She says, and actually it took a while to sink in, because we don't see any reaction here right away. In fact, he thought it through. Do you realize what he had to think about? He had to consider the fact that he was married to a Jew. He had signed earlier an edict that said to kill all Jews on such and such date. So he had to process that through his mind. He had to think, well, is she my enemy now? That was to be considered under consideration. The reason I say maybe an enemy is because the king was part of a signing of that law to annihilate. And I wonder, if you remember back when the signing took place, Haman had brought this law into him and read it to him. And remember how we commented then that it didn't seem to specifically point to the fact that it was Jews? He just brought this in and said, here's some people, as Haman said. Here's some people that we need to get rid of. They're a problem. Oh, okay, give me the law and we'll sign it in. I don't think that he realized it was a direct attack on Jews. I may be wrong in that, but it doesn't seem to be that way. Verse 4, "For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male or female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." She goes on here and she says, "I've been sold to death, not just slavery. If it were just slavery, I wouldn't have said anything. I would have let that go on without saying anything. It would have been a very stupid thing on your part, by the way, O king." Because the Jews, which we talked about this, they had about 2 million of them in the land and in that area. So that would have been a lot of revenue loss. There was 30 million dollars or so committed by Haman to the king's treasure if he would let him destroy this group of people. And that's all the king heard. Remember when we talked about that? He says, oh, $30 million? I just went through a very costly war, and we just lost that war, and I need some more dough in the treasury. So these Jews were very prosperous. If you kill them, she says, you'll not only hurt me, but you'll financially be the big loser. So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther in verse 5, "Who is he and where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" This king is, again, he's out to lunch. I don't know what the deal is with this guy. It seems like he just doesn't have a clue of what is going on in his palace. This guy astonishes me, because I hope our president nowadays doesn't function this way. Okay. I thought I'd throw that out there. Because he is unaware of the plot, and then when it is revealed that this plot might affect him, he's furious. Me? You mean, you know, I did this? And all of a sudden, he was very, very upset. It is no wonder that history says that this guy was assassinated in his palace by the second in command, his prime minister, in 465 B.C. Or excuse me, 465 B.C. he was assassinated, and this timing right here was 474 B.C. in the 12th year of his reign. So in about another, 9 years or so, he's going to be knocked off by his prime minister. This guy just, he didn't pay attention. Verse 6, and Esther said, the adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman. By the way, Haman was at dinner. He probably choked on his wine about then. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. I don't doubt it. Haman, he has no answer for that either. Doesn't have a word to say. He's dumbfounded to learn that Esther is a Jew. I bet he was. To be sitting there at the table and find out that the queen was a Jew. Oh my. Never in his wildest dream did it occur. And you know, and I thought about that. Why? You know, a crafty old guy like Haman, why wouldn't he have checked that out or had any suspicion? Well, I think God was behind the scene on that one too. And that's the way God works. I mean, things work out at times where you just, whoa, it's perfectly set up. That's because God was in it. And Esther said, the adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman. So he doesn't have any kind. I mean, he's terrified now before the king and the queen. He has no answer for it. He's dumbfounded to learn that she's a Jew. God's moving behind the scenes. God's watching over his own. Do you realize that tonight? He knows what's going on in your life. He knows the people that are attacking you. He knows the, you know, I'm talking about his children, his born-again children. He is at watch over you, whether you realize it or not. And I love that part about God. Because I used to, before I really gave my life completely over to him, I used to be kind of terrified of what was out there and what was the next step. I used to go into a dark room and I'd think, whoo-hoo. And the hair'd stick up on the back of my neck. Now I can go through a dark room and I'll think it. And I'll say, God's with me. No matter what happens, God is with me. And that is such a wonderful comfort to a Christian. No weapon formed against Israel that will prosper. No weapon ever devised by man will be able to come against Israel and prosper as long as God is on the watch. Now, yes, I know, Israel has been attacked and lost millions. But there's good reason for it, and God is in control, and he's not done with them yet. God is going to bless those folks and bless the Jews and curse those who curse the Jews. And the providence of God is going to keep the children of Israel because he has chosen, for whatever reason, he has chosen to work through them in the history of man, and he's still at work. I am preparing the prophecy update information for Friday night, and I hope all of you come Friday night. 7 o'clock, we're going to do a prophecy update, and it's amazing as I look back over the year. All the different things that have occurred, and Israel is usually right in the middle of it. In the middle of it all. Then the king arose in his wrath, verse 7, from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. This king, he could not take it all in. His anger was just erupting, and so he says, I got to leave. I got to go out to my garden and walk around and cool off. And this Haman knew that he was within inches of a death. So while he's gone out of the room, Haman knows the only soft heart in the entire palace was the queen. And so he turns to her. How many times I have been in a situation that after the world has done everything to destroy the work of God's hand in my life, when I know I'm in trouble, at the brink of destruction, and then I remember that God's providence is behind me. And it takes a whole different attitude and look. There is a promise of bearing fruit in our lives by God to His children when we will turn to Him. Now, I know that there isn't a guarantee to say that, you know, you're going to be delivered from the lion's mouth just like Daniel. But at the same time, I can't tell you tonight that you won't be either. God is in control, and He is the provider of His people. And He does see this whole situation. Remember how bleak it looked early on in chapters? It looked like Satan was just running at will and having great victory in every step of the way. And you almost want to say, where's God? Where's God in all this? And now we're seeing where God is. But listen, my friends, it sometimes takes time. And it takes patience on our part. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Oh my goodness, this guy, he doesn't have a clue. When the king comes in, you know, right at that brink of walking in the doorway, here's Haman draped over his queen. Oh, please, please, he's begging for his life. And in fact, if you look at the language here, it is as if he is almost on top of her. Amazing. This guy was so freaked out that he just drapes himself over the queen. And then the king says, will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? And as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. The noose was on its way. What this means and implies is the palace eunuchs, they knew exactly what to do, and they covered the face of the man condemned to death. Now, Harbona, one of the eunuchs in verse 9, said to the king, look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. You know, it was known throughout the palace that Haman had made these gallows for Mordecai. Probably from his boasting. He didn't keep anything quiet. This reminds me of the thing Paul says in Galatians 6:7. Listen to some of these verses that we really need to know and understand. They're great principles for us. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. And then Job, we're getting ready to study that book next. Even as I have seen, verse 8 of chapter 4, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. Proverbs 22:8. He who sows iniquity will reap sorrow, and the rod of his anger will fail. You know, these are age-old principles written thousands of years ago that do not change. They do not change ever. You can take them to the bank more than you could take anything to the bank in these days and know that they are going to come true. They are part of life even today. I don't know that you can, you know, the timing is always a question, but you will reap what you sow. So I'm out there sowing good things. I want to sow good seed, don't you? So that you reap a good harvest. That's the principle behind it. If you do good, you'll get good. And people say, yeah, but I have been doing good. And look at this. You know, I'm getting rotten fruit. well, then there's something wrong along the way somewhere. Or God is trying to show you some specific thing. There's a reason for it. Haman never paid any attention to these things, and he is now going to be an example of what God would have us to pay attention to. Psalms 37 says in verses 35 and 6, it says, I have seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a native green tree, yet he passed away, and behold, he was no more. Indeed, I sought him, but he could not be found. Do you see what the psalmist is saying here? It's interesting that he explains that there are times that the wicked look like a natural full-grown tree growing by the river banks where there's lots of water and fertile soil, and the wicked are just getting away with all kinds of stuff, and their tree is so lush and looks so good. But then the forester comes along with the axe, and he chops down that vigorous tree. God has a plan, and even though the wicked do seem to prosper at times, their end is coming. God will deal with wickedness. You can be a villain if you want to be one, but know this, you'll live a very rough life. There is no guarantees of help. You can run against God's plan and purpose for you, but you won't defeat God. I don't care how big and powerful you think you are, because you are going to just pass off the stage one day. I think of guys I used to study. I used to be intrigued by the Al Capones of Chicago's 20s, and I've read some of their books. And he died in a Florida state prison of syphilis. But he was a powerful guy for a time. People in this world glorify their power for a time, but in the end, they usually get what they reap. That is what happened to Haman, and that is what happens to every single person that is in rebellion to God. Oh, that they won't all hang on a gallows. I know that. They won't all get the judgment that I think maybe they should get sometimes if I were God. And I'm glad that I'm not God. God has mercy, and he has much more of a way to understand people. But they will die in their sin, and they will be condemned. What's that say to all to us? Well, it should spur us on to be ever so more dutiful to share the gospel. The gospel-saving grace of God's hand. We should be diligent. We live in a time that is getting so close, so short. And there are a lot of people lost in even Dallas, Oregon. And we need to be spurred on, really, to share the gospel. Those of us that have come to the Lord are pardoned because he hung on a tree for us in our places. And by faith in him, we are pardoned. Amazing, amazing story. So let's get right into chapter 8 here, verses 1 and 2. And on that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Okay, the house of Haman was really pretty wealthy. He had a lot of money. He was a powerful guy in that country, and he had acquired a lot of property. So again, God shows he is in ultimate control, and he will turn the tables 180 degrees on Satan's plans and intentions. And Esther finally told the king that Mordecai had raised her and that they were actually cousins. So the king now realizes that he's related to Mordecai. Not only, I mean, this guy got shocked completely. Now Mordecai is his married relative. Now Esther gives the entire estate of Haman to her father-like guy, Mordecai, the house of Haman. That's amazing. Now Esther spoke again to the king, verse 3, fell down at his feet and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. You know, they still had a very big problem. Remember, the law of Medes and Persians could not be revoked or changed, period. He couldn't just say, okay, well, I made a mistake. It just wasn't that way. She pleads for her countrymen here. She didn't plead for her own life. You notice that? She's a pretty neat woman. She pleads for her countrymen. I am always impressed by so many that down through the years the Jews have been prayed for. You know, the Jews, as long as I have gone to church, have been, in the churches I've went to anyway, lifted up and prayed for. And really, every pastor I've sat under has helped us to understand that they are God's chosen people and that we are to pray for them. Psalms 122:6 says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper who love thee. Ooh, don't you like that one? Maybe that's why all those pastors told me to do that. Because if we will pray for them, they shall prosper who love thee. There can be no peace in this world until there is peace in Jerusalem. Do you realize that? And there can be no peace in Jerusalem unless God's people obey his command and pray, thy kingdom come, either. So it's kind of it's a tough one. It's a dilemma, but it's coming to a certain point. Listen to what R.A. Torrey, a great writer, wrote, and I quote, it was a masterstroke of the devil when he got the church and the ministry so generally to lie aside the mighty weapon of prayer. That's happening today. The mighty weapon of prayer, one of the least attended services in our church and in any church that I've talked to with the pastors when we get together, is prayer meetings. And for whatever reason, the devil has gotten a foothold in just nullifying its power. The devil is perfectly willing that the church should multiply in its organizations, Torrey goes on to say, and its deftly contrived machinery, boy, that's a mouthful, for the conquest of the world for Christ, if it will only give up praying. Get them busy. Get them concerned about new carpeting, buildings, parking lots. Get them involved with ministries outside of the church. But whatever you do, don't let them pray. Why? Because there's power in prayer, my friends. There is power that we do not understand its fullness. We need to pray, and we need to pray privately. We need to pray publicly. And we need to pray corporately. We need to take after Esther's example and intercede for others in this world in prayer. Now, I know we were talking about this in Bible study in prison last night. There's the scriptures that Jesus talks in Matthew 6 that says, go into your prayer closet, close the door, and pray. He didn't mean that as a universal overall prayer, because there's many public prayers in the Bible. Many. Ezra, we just studied, was one of them in Ezra 9. So I would challenge you to make sure that you are praying in your private time, but pray corporately too, and attend some of these prayer meetings as you can. And the king held out the golden scepter, that's verse 4, toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it pleases the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? Esther makes it quite plain to the king that the judgment against Haman is of no avail, really, unless something is done to save her people. Something must be done to save them. And then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, "Indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews, as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke." You see, the law of the Medes and the Persians was made so that even the king could not revoke or change a law because, and here's the reason, they thought that the king was a god. And if he is a god, I mean, it makes common sense. If you are a god, you can't make a mistake, right? So if you write a law, then it must be perfect, right? Well, they couldn't revoke it. No mistakes. Now, that is true only if you serve God Almighty, not a man elevated, a man god. That doesn't work because he's a sinner. That's the basic problem. He says to Mordecai, "You have the ring. I gave that ring. I took it off old Haman's finger just before they hung him. And I put it on your hand, and that ring carries a sealing power. And so, you have the power. You go ahead and write something." We always see this guy passing the buck, don't we? He's a guy, this king, Ahasuerus, he was a guy that just, he wanted to not have any responsibility. Maybe he was really into golf, or maybe he was into, what's that thing where you, the round ball and the wooden hammer thing? Yeah, maybe he was into croquet. I don't know. But he sure wasn't into governing. Okay, so moving on there in verse 9. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written, according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the province from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. Okay, the royal secretaries, they were summoned. And they were summoned at once, and they said, okay, you got to get the printing presses rolling. We have 127 provinces to get this law out before it takes place, and they start killing Jews. So we've got to get it out. And remember how they did it the first time. They had to write it in all these various languages. And so that would be a real tough thing. It's May, June, this Sivan time, and it's been 2 months and 10 days after Haman had issued the first decree. They wrote out Mordecai's orders to the Jews and to the other government officials in the 127 provinces. And he wrote in verse 10, "In the name of the king Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on the horseback, riding on royal horses bred with swift steeds. By these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar." So, this is what Mordecai came up with. The new decree would let everybody in the empire know that the king wanted his people to have different attitudes towards the Jews and look upon them favorably. He was married to one now. So he was motivated to get it right. What he did was he gave the Jews permission to defend themselves against anybody who would try to kill them and take their property. Remember, that was supposed to take place very, very soon. And so to counterbalance that, he couldn't discontinue it. So to counterbalance it, he says, okay, you Jews, you're authorized to gather together, band together, form yourself an army or a police group, and you can attack anybody that attacks you. And in fact, you can kill them and you can take their money and property. There were many people in the empire like Haman, just like Haman, who hated the Jews, wanted to destroy them and get their hands on their wealth. Well, this new decree allowed the Jews to assemble and defend themselves, but they were not allowed to be the aggressors. So the people had to realize that at about the same time that the first decree would take effect, the second one also would come into effect, and the Jews would have the right to defend and kill if killed. It would be really this nullifying law. The first law came down and it laid it out where they were guilty. If you're a Jew, you were to be killed. The new law providing a way of escape. You know, that reminds me of a beautiful picture. A beautiful picture of our lives today and the plan that God has sent forth to save us. The law, what's the law? The Ten Commandments? The first five books of the law that Moses wrote, and no man could live up to it, could he? No man can live out the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus lays forth. None of us can live up to the law perfectly. And so that creates a dilemma for God. And God has to have a solution, and he did have a solution. He devised a plan to send his one and only Son to pay the penalty for our sin. That's amazing, isn't it? That he would send his Son to take our place because we're guilty, we've blown it, we didn't live up to it. He sends his Son, just like this edict here was sent out in every language to everybody on the ends of the earth. Jesus, when he left, he says, go forth now and make disciples of men, baptizing them in my name, in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. We are to go and make disciples. And there is so much information on the internet and on Bibles galore. I read a statistic, and I may have already shared this with you. Forgive me if I have. But I read a statistic, one of the latest polls taken, that in the average household in America, there are four Bibles. In every single house, at least four Bibles. And yet, that same statistic said that there was really only 41% of those polled that said they ever read that Bible. We are a society that has the Word available to us galore, and yet we don't take advantage of it. Whoa. There's a serious accounting coming up. A copy of the document was to be issued, verse 13, as a decree in every province, and published for all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan, the citadel. Okay, so the law goes out. The printing press stops. They got all these copies to take out, written in many different languages. They get on their camels, they get on their donkeys, they get on their chariots, their horses, anything that they can get the word out and to these many different countries. Remember, we've talked about this from southeast China, clear to Africa, the Medes and the Persians. The Persian Empire was large. It was a very large country. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, verse 15, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. the Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. I love that. When the edict became known throughout the provinces, there was great joy among the Jewish people. No doubt, they were facing death. They were pardoned, weren't they? Accompanied by feasting and other celebrations. What a turnaround in just less than 3 months. 3 months prior to that, they were facing death, annihilation in a foreign land. They were probably second-guessing their decision to stay in Babylon area instead of going back with the other groups to Jerusalem. Haman, he issued a decree that brought fear and death, but Mordecai issued one that brought joy everlasting. When God gets a hold of a life, oh, then in a moment, your outlook can change. It really can. You know, we have that available to us. It's a decision we make. If God's gotten a hold of your life tonight, know that you can tap in on the joy. You don't have to wallow in the sadness. You don't have to struggle in the mindset of, woe is me. People of other nationalities and peoples of other lands, they became Jews out of the fear of what the Jews might do to them. But that wasn't the only reason. They saw what a great God the Jews had. And you and I, if we will talk about it more, we have a great Jesus, don't we? We have a great Savior dwelling within our hearts and our souls that's willing to walk with us and talk with us. A Savior that went to the cross for our place. The statement that they became Jews may mean that they pretended to be Jews just to get out of, maybe the attack of a Jew or that sort of thing. They had seen the tables turned. There will be one day. We're really the minority as Christians in the world today, but that won't always be the case. There will be a day when we're not the minority. I look forward to that day, and I hope you do too. The Lord has a plan, and it's unfolding, and we live in the most exciting generation of all time. We are the generation, I firmly believe, as we look at prophecy, as we look at the signs of the times, and the natural things going on in this world right now. I'm so excited to bring this Friday night, because there's been such a great happening in 2010, and there is an awesome happening in 2011. I think 2011 is the year that we're going to see some mighty big things on the scene of prophecy as God's hand starts to move miraculously, swiftly. I'm looking forward to it.